This program is brought to you by Emory University.
This book report is brought to you by Emory Report.
My name is Mark Auslander. I'm an assistant professor of anthropology at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. I'm a former faculty member in anthropology at Emory University. I'm the author of the forthcoming book, The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of the American South. I'll be participating in the conference that I've helped organize at Emory in early February, and that's the conference, Slavery and the University, History and Legacies. So this is from the book's prologue. On a warm morning in July 2009, I found myself nervously mounting the steps of a modest house in Rockford, Illinois, not quite sure what kind of welcome I might receive within. I was, in a sense, at the conclusion of a journey I had begun a decade earlier. In September 1999, as I began teaching at Oxford College, the original campus of Emory University, in the small town of Oxford, Georgia, I had become fascinated with the often-told story of the enslaved woman known as Miss Kitty, and her owner, Bishop James Osgood Andrew, first president of Emory's Board of Trustees. Kitty, I had been half-jokingly told by a number of Oxford residents, Kitty is really the person who caused the Civil War. Bishop Andrew's ownership of slaves, including Miss Kitty in 1844, had occasioned national controversy, leading to a great schism in the Methodist Episcopal Church that was regarded in local circles as a dress rehearsal for the succession of the slave-holding state 17 years later. For years, I had followed intense debates over the circumstances of Kitty's life and the bishop's precise connection with slavery. Most white people in Oxford insisted that the bishop had offered Kitty her freedom in 1841, that she had refused emancipation out of loyalty to the bishop and his wife. The bishop was thus only a, quote, accidental slave owner, unquote, and fairly accused of slave owning by hypocritical and fanatical Northern Methodists who understood nothing of the deep affection and loyalty felt by Kitty and her fellow slaves for their master and mistress. To be sure, the town's African-American residents had little patience with this version of events. Miss Kitty, they held, was most likely the bishop's mistress, and he the probable father of her children. She had hardly been offered a fair chance at freedom, they insisted. The multiple memorials in town to the story of Kitty and Bishop Andrew, erected by whites over the years, were a constant affront to persons of color. While local whites insisted Kitty had married a free man of color named Nathan Shell, African Americans were skeptical that such a man had ever existed. Yet across the lines of race and difference, all wondered what had become of Kitty's children and her posterity. How, I had long wondered, had these competing versions of the myth of Kitty coexisted in this community for over a century and a half? Had the details of the stories altered over time, and had the meanings of the tales themselves shifted? Why had the narrative deeply moved so many whites and profoundly troubled so many African Americans across the generations? What, in fact, was the relationship of James Osgood Andrew to Miss Kitty and to the institution of slavery? How many slaves had Bishop Andrew held or owned during his lifetime, and what had happened to them and their descendants in slavery and freedom? Seeking answers to these questions had taken me on a long and winding trail. With my students at Oxford College, I had worked with community members in documenting and restoring Oxford's historic African-American cemetery, where Miss Kitty and others owned by Bishop Andrew were buried. I had pored through documents in county courthouses, archives, and household attics in Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Washington, D.C., and Iowa. Most important, my journey had taken me deep into varying encounters with religious faith in America, a country which remains to this day deeply embedded in the complex tapestry of race and the unresolved legacies of slavery. I had attended scores of worship services, meeting hundreds of people who sensed a profound emotional and spiritual bond to Miss Kitty or Bishop Andrew. A white congregation had hewed to the standard white narrative that Kitty was deeply loyal to James Andrew and that the bishop was a martyred victim of Northern intolerance. With equal passion, an Afrocentric church had held an ancestral walk to the site of Kitty's renovated slave quarters, pouring out libations to her and giving her a new name in the West African Uwe language, as they heard her spirit declare she was a victim of sexual assault by 19th century white clergymen. In the old Springfield Baptist Church in Augusta, Georgia, within the physical building that Miss Kitty had once worshipped as a child, I was led in a prayer by the elderly pastor that Miss Kitty's children's children would be someday found and brought back to Springfield Church. Such prayers were echoed in churches in Oxford, Georgia, Summerfield, Alabama, and Washington, D.C. Yet in all this work, to my deep disappointment, I had not been able to trace any of Miss Kitty's living descendants and I had become convinced none existed. Now, in summer 2009, the trail had suddenly turned hot. A Freeman's Bank record from 1871 had indicated that Kitty really had an African-American husband named Nathan, who had fathered children with her. The eldest of these children, a man named Alfred Boyd, had appeared within a year after the Civil War in, of all places, the small town of Keosauqua, Iowa. So in July 2009, accompanied by my wife and fellow anthropologist Ellen Schatzneider, I traveled to Iowa and began to trace the career of Kitty's eldest son. Alfred had, we soon learned, become a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and spent his career serving in congregations across the Midwest. With help from church members, archival records, and court documents, I finally located Reverend Alfred Boyd's great-grandson, Mr. Lee Caldwell, a man in his 80s who still worshipped at Allen Chapel AME Church, the institution his great-grandfather had pastored a century earlier. The church's current pastor, Reverend Virgil, would kindly agree to accompany me to Mr. Caldwell's home and introduce me. Now, standing on the house's threshold, I was enormously excited but also anxious. Would Mr. Caldwell have any interest in his family history? And would his family memories confirm or undercut the histories I had reconstructed? Would he and his family regard my visit as an intrusion? What would it mean to them to learn that their ancestors had for so long been a subject of fascination and debate, a veritable object of myth and community so far away from them? What would it mean that the story of Miss Kitty, over which I had so long been obsessed, would now belong at long last to her descendants? The door was opened by Mr. Caldwell, a handsome, smiling man, a little bit unsteady on his cane, but with a firm and friendly gaze. He engaged in raucous repartee with the pastor, whom he had not seen for a while, and invited us into the parlor. As he sat next to me on the sofa, he turned with a twinkle in his eye and a spirit of fun in his voice. "Now, young man, what can I do for you, and what can you do for me?"
The preceding program is copyrighted by Emory University. Please visit us at emory.edu.